Network. I handle most of the audio that goes on during the show and many of the promos that you hear. Do you need audio production for a special project? Maybe a website. Perhaps you'd like to turn your book into an audiobook. Perhaps you'd like some sound effects for your independent movie or voiceover for an animated movie. Maybe you'd like to...
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
This is a top to a, you know, what we use on stage, but it's very, very special because if you can see,
yeah,
the numbers all go to 11. Look, right across the board, 11,
oh,
11,
and most of
11,
and amps go up to 10.
Exactly.
Does that mean it's louder? Is it any louder?
Well, it's one louder, isn't it? It's not 10. You see, most blokes are going to be playing at 10. You're on 10 here, all the way up, all the way up,
yeah,
all the way up. You're on 10 on your guitar. Where can you go from there? Where?
I don't know.
Nowhere, exactly. What we do is if we need that extra push over the cliff, you know what we do?
Put it up to 11.
11, exactly. One louder.
Why don't you just make 10 louder and make 10 be the top number and make that a little louder?
These go to 11.
Welcome to Conversation Radio's Lean, Mean, and Green Show right here on the Horn. It's Foxed Up with John Fox, where we turn the conversation to conservation. Foxed Up is brought to you by B1 Louder Productions in Sydney, Australia, and CityNet, citynet.net. B1 Louder by ringing 877-4-HEAD-ON. That's 877-443-2366, or use your free minutes by dialing direct 304-658-5453. Yeah. Your host, the ranting, head-banging hippie, John Fox.
Ho, ho, ho! Hey, everybody, how we going? Welcome to Foxed Up here on another Sunday night or Monday afternoon, all depending on where you reside on this beautiful blue marble such that it is. Welcome to the Horn, everybody. And I'm just kind of looking around the studio here. We're using a completely different rig. I've got some of the band's gear here, and well, I had to patch it in to do some work. So, and it's way cool. It's way cool. It's digital. And it's not 30 years old and sounding decrepit like my gear. But anyway, welcome to the show, everybody. We've got tons to do today. Gene sent me some amazing stuff for the show today. And the first two links that he sent in his list, which he put a little bit of a marker on, saying, I think these are good. He was spot on. Completely blew out the doors everything that I had planned for today. And there's this amazing piece at the Atlantic, and we're going to talk about it fairly in depth today. How a new jobless era will transform America. And it's huge. It's like this 4-page long, you know, I don't think a right-winger will get past the first two paragraphs because it's far too nuanced. And, yeah, it's a blanket statement, but sorry, it's true. It gets into just the nitty-gritty of the youth being left behind kind of every 10 years the psychological impacts of long-term unemployment. We're going to get there. And there's other stuff to get to. As normal in hour two, David from Maine will be popping in with the mystery track of the week. And I got a couple of things on music psychology to discuss with David this week. So just something that popped up in the morning news here on the ABC. We'll get there, too. On top of that, we got a thing about, you know, the not-so-greenness of some of the green movement. Google storming ahead with solar geothermal, and we could be seeing them actually generating power in a couple of years. And that's an amazing thing, you know. I am so of two minds with Google, even though I am a huge Google user. I mean, I'm on Gmail and all that. But I do understand the idea of so much information being in one place. And the idea of do no harm, although a wonderful catchphrase when something becomes as huge as Google is that really possible? But I do think they, in general, try to do their best. And I also think that Google, for one, understands the idea of energy security, and when you're running a tech company that runs more servers than, like, any other outfit in the world, having power is crucial, obviously. So, I mean, they're looking to do things for their own salvation. But we'll get into that stuff a little bit later. And before we get too far, over on the blog post, thank you, Gene, there is a link to buy tickets. If you happen to be one of the listeners that lives here in Australia, Swivelhead has a gig at the end of the month, 27th of March, at the Baldface Stag. Tickets are on sale, 2-for-1. Check out the link. Love to see you there. And we're doing the same lineup as the last gig because it was just such a nice block of four bands. We just thought, hell, we'll do it all over again. So that's that. And like I said, there's tons to talk about. The Chinese have just released a huge report on their environmental problems. And it's interesting. You know, it's interesting when you look at it and think, there seems to be a little bit more acceptance of reality in a place that is supposedly not a free country, in a place, but, you know, it's a really hard one because, you know, China is just doing all the jobs that America and a bunch of the rest of the world, you know, shipped overseas. And, you know, because of that fact, most of a lot of the carbon footprint that should actually be in the nation of the United States or attributed to is not. And this creates a fudging of the books kind of situation, and it allows forces who would rather not see a cleaner, greener economy to lay the blame at the foot of the Chinese, as opposed to just laying the blame with ourselves. You know, the Chinese wouldn't be making quite the disaster of their country at the scale that it is if it weren't for the fact that we have, over the past 30 years, just shipped all our frickin' jobs down there. And it's just, it ain't gonna work. And I'm just scanning the chat room for a couple of comments here, and as I look down, I am very happy that my good friend Bruce Birch is in the chat room. It's been a long time since I've seen you, friend, and it's good to see you in the room, man. Good to see you back amongst the family. And for those of you that don't know, Bruce and I hosted one of the first shows here on the Horn. Fourth Estate Radio, and Bruce had his own show, All Things Reconsidered, which morphed into the Bruce Birch program. And one day we'll have you back on air, mate. We miss your voice. And seriously, very few people have I ever come across who have had such a natural just touch for this job. And I call it job, not like we're getting paid. But anyway, enough of the ass-kissing of my old friends. But, you know, we're gonna get into this jobless thing here in just a minute. And strap in. Strap in. This is some heavy stuff, and I'm not gonna read the whole thing, because it would take me almost the whole three-hour program, probably, to do. But we're gonna hit some of the highlights of it, and let's have a read of it. And you'll be, of course, you can find the links to all this at foxdup.headonradionetwork.com. The email comes into John, J-O-N, at headonradionetwork.com. If you want to ring into the show later when we open up the Skype line, you can find us on foxdup on Skype. What the hell else? Oh, you can find us on Facebook. You can find it, you know, you can find us everywhere. Anyway. Yeah, I'm trying to remember all this stuff that I never do because, you know, the intro runs and I just kind of open up mouth, start diarrhea of the mouth. And I sometimes forget this stuff. And on another programming note, I was hoping to be filling in for Bob Kincaid this week while he's on the road. But unfortunately, logistically, we could not get the phones working, and to not have the regular phones for Head On would just like not be Head On. So Bob and I have made the executive decision that we'll let it go, hang out, folks. And as Bob said before it was done on the weekend, you know, even though it might be reruns, doesn't mean we still don't need the support. And enough with the plug until, well, you know, we get to the end of the program where I'll probably do it again. But what are we doing now? Pardon me. Things are a little different here. I got to shift things. But I tell you what we're going to do. I'm going to get myself situated for getting into this heavy, heavy, heavy bit of journalism. And I don't know. Let's play some music while I do that. So for your listening pleasure, a bit of some classic, great, sometimes an underrated band in my mind, one of the best kind of pop rock bands to ever walk, The Cars. And oh, we'll just start with a classic, My Best Friend's Girl. We'll be back. You're listening to Foxed Up on the Horn, America's liberal voice. We'll be back right after this. You meet right, and that would be The Cars from way back in the 80s sometime. My Best Friend's Girl. Okay, let's get into the nitty-gritty of things here, and just kind of having a look at operational stuff, because like I said, this is all a little bit new, but I'm digging this digital thing. It's very cool. Anyway, over at The Atlantic, Don Peck has written this masterpiece. Really nails so many things, it's hard to kind of wrap up into a line or two. But he opens up, you know, how a new jobless era will transform America. The Great Recession may be over, but the era of high joblessness is probably just beginning. Before it ends, it will likely change the life course and character of a generation of young adults. It will leave an indelible imprint on many blue-collar men. It could cripple marriage as an institution in many communities. It may already be plunging many inner cities into a despair not seen for decades. Ultimately, it is likely to warp our politics, our culture, and the character of our society for many years to come. I know this sounds all like really, really depressing, but seriously, we need to look at what this current system is not only just doing to the country in general, but what it's doing to the generations that haven't even had a bloody chance to get started. And so Don, you know, starts off saying, how should we characterize the economic period we have now entered? After nearly two brutal years, the Great Recession appears to be over, at least technically. Yet a return to normalcy seems far off. By some measures, each recession since the 1980s has retreated more slowly than the one before it, and this is absolutely true. In one sense, we never fully recovered from the last one. In 2001, the share of civilian population with a job never returned to its previous peak before this downturn began. And incomes were still stagnant throughout the decade. Still, the weakness that lingered through much of the 2000s shouldn't be confused with the trauma of the past 2 years, a trauma that will remain heavy for quite some time. The unemployment rate hit 10% in October, and there are good reasons to believe that by 2011, 2012, or even 2014, it will have declined only a little. Late last year, the average duration of unemployment surpassed 6 months, for the first time that has happened since 1948, when the Bureau of Labor Statistics began tracking that number. As for this writing, for every open job in the U.S., six people are actively looking for work. Now, trying to think where I saw this over the weekend. For the life of me, I want to think that it was actually on Real Time with Bill Maher that you know, actually probably I'm thinking about Bob now that I think about it. First of all, you know, capitalism, we understand, is a zero-sum game. When there are winners, there have to be losers. But now thinking about it, I believe it was on Real Time. And it may have been Arianna Huffington. Can't believe that I'm not able to recall, but when you look at the last 2 years, all this decline, all the layoffs, everything, in the last financial year, American productivity still increased 5%. All those job losses, and the employed end up running on the treadmill even faster to keep it going. And, yeah, it was Real Time. And I think it was Maher who used this example of some really, really, really fucked up concept of a show where there's some reality show that's just started up where, like, bosses go undercover and spend time with their lowly employees as an employee. And these people are surprised when they find out that they're thought of as assholes. And one of the instances that was mentioned was, you know, one guy who ran, I guess, some sort of sanitation outfit went riding with his employees and suddenly discovered that a woman who worked on one of his, you know, trucks was having to pee into a cup because there were no actual scheduled breaks. Right. And you're telling me that people aren't fighting to keep their jobs. This woman has to go through the humiliation of having to pee into a cup. And so, as I understand, Bill was... I haven't seen this god-awful thing. But, you know, the guy's shocked at this. And then, you know, at the end of the show, there's some sort of, you know... here's $5,000, I'm sorry. Has he changed any policy? Has he changed anything about the breaks? Hell no. Hell no. Prince and the Pauper. Yeah. Don't pay for peeing, but fuck, before you want the job, piss in this cup so we can test you whether you might decide to, you know, have a joint on your day off, for fuck's sake. I mean, how ass backwards? How ass backwards? So, once again, and see, this whole idea that productivity has raised 5% in the United States during this fucking absolutely engineered collapse. And you have assholes, thank you for the cue there, I think it was Sparky. You know, Tom DeLay, the guy who is fucking nuts from all the cockroach chemicals he snorted.
Unemployment benefits deter people from wanting to get a job.
Fuck you. Seriously. I can't even restrain my language when I hear shit like this. Here's a guy who, you know, at some time actually worked for a living. But somewhere along the line, you know, he went nuts. Now, the fact that this guy's still being called up for his opinion when he should be in prison is a whole nother scary thing. But you gotta watch how these, you know, this piece at the Atlantic is getting at the heart of something. The workers are not the problem. Same thing happens here in Australia. Every time. The workers of America or the workers of Australia are forced to work harder. They do. And yet, over the past 30 years, real income has stayed stagnant. Now, you want to go with all these market, you know, mofos. If productivity is increasing, pay should have increased. But the whole system is ass backwards. I think I'm, again, pulling from Bill Maher. The whole system is ass backwards. The rich want their 90% up front. I'm so glad Bill Maher's back. You know, these people want the 90% up front, and then the rest of us that make it all happen for them, because I'm not afraid to associate myself as a worker, because I do things. I make things. I make things like this radio show. I create things like performances for people to go and see. And unless the boss is a one-man operation, he has nothing if it weren't for the fact that his employees do the work that he doesn't want to do himself, or can't do himself. There's a lot of really untalented people in high positions, and it's a bit freaky. You know, and... Yeah, and, you know, Bruce makes a comment, you know, blaming workman's comp insurance for creating the whole culture of drug testing. Well, I remember even before that, I remember, you know, when I first entered the workforce, and this was in the mid late 80s, you know, when I was first working as a teenager, and suddenly, you know, with the whole just say no and drug fear campaigns that went on, suddenly if you smoked a joint, it meant you were going to rip off your boss. So we were all convinced that it was all okay for us to pee in the cup for the job because we had to prove we were innocent. Now, I'm not saying in situations where you're working with heavy machinery, stuff like that, but they're, you know, you need to then be testing for alcohol and other things. But this idea that your boss can infringe on your private time because on the weekend after you busted your ass for bullshit money to make your boss a lot of money, God forbid you want to go out and actually, you know, maybe relax. But as long as you're drinking alcohol, that's okay. Doesn't matter if you're a wreck. But, see, that's a legal drug. And, you know, we all got suckered into this thing. And I'm sorry, it's bullshit. Now, yeah, I want my pilots tested. I want my train engineers tested, you know. But the kid that's stocking shelves at your Walmart, he should be able to do whatever the hell he wants on his own time. You know, and you know, there's some interesting things about further on in this article about the view of what a career should offer that has been changing through generations. And when you have a generation that has grown up seeing that whole, you know, lifetime of work for a lifetime of dedication kind of concept be a complete crock of shit as they watch their parents get cast away, you know, at the drop of a hat, you start to think a little bit differently and start to question the reality of what people believe is true. But anyway, let me get back to this article. Every open job in the U.S., 6 people actively looking for work. Okay. All these figures understate the magnitude of the jobs crisis. The broadest measures of unemployment and underemployment, which includes people who want to work but have stopped actively searching for a job, along with those who want full-time jobs but can only find part-time work, reached 17.4% in October, which appears to be the highest figure since the 1930s. And for large swaths of society, young adults, men, minorities, that figure was much higher. Among teenagers, for instance, the narrowest measure of unemployment stood at roughly 27%. One recent survey showed that 44% of families had experienced job loss, a reduction in hours, or a pay cut in the past year. That's 44. Can I just say that again? One recent survey showed that 44% of families had experienced a job loss, a reduction in hours, or a pay cut in the past year. And Tim asks, what's Australia's unemployment? I'll have to check. It's not 10%. That much I know. Because, well, to repeat myself, Australia did a go at a real stimulus. And Australia has weathered the economic quote unquote downturn better than any other nation on the planet. So, you know, again, you know, I keep saying, old Obama needs to take Kevin on tour. But Kev's got his hands full at the moment over here. You know, one of our chatters right now just said, you know, another example, hours reduced in January. And this depression has lasted more than a year. Well, there you go, Bruce. Thank you. 5.4%. Yep, 5.4%. Now, I'm not sure if this government had a chance in when they redid employment laws when they came in, whether or not they changed the very American practice that was introduced during the Howard regime, that once someone has been unemployed for a certain amount of time, they just are removed from the statistics. So that said, I would say that Australia's real unemployment figure is probably closer to, say, 8-9%. And if in the United States, one of these things here said, you know, 17%, I would say that that's probably closer to 25-30%. Because we have picked up some of the same little accounting games when we had the conservatives in control. Now, continuing on with this piece from The Atlantic, I'm going to skip down a little bit. He says, the worst effects of pervasive joblessness on family politics society take time to incubate, and they show themselves only slowly, but ultimately they leave deep marks that endure long after boom times have returned. Some of these marks are just now becoming visible, and even if the economy magically and fully recovers tomorrow, new ones will continue to appear. The longer our economic slump lasts, the deeper they'll be. If it persists much longer, this era of high joblessness will likely change the life course and character of a generation of young adults, and quite possibly those of the children behind them as well. It will leave an indelible imprint on many blue-collar white men and on white culture. It could change the nature of modern marriage and also cripple marriage as an institution in many communities. It may already be plunging many inner cities into a kind of despair and dysfunction not seen for decades. Ultimately, it is likely to warp our politics and culture and the character of our society for years. And in the next section, skipping down again, the long road ahead, he says, historically, financial crises have spawned long periods of economic malaise, and this crisis so far has been true to form. Despite the bailouts, many banks' balance sheets remain weak. More than 140 banks have failed in 2009. As a result, banks have kept lending standards tight, frustrating the efforts of small businesses, which have accounted for almost half of all job losses, to invest or rehire. Exports seem unlikely to provide much of a boost. How can you expect exports to provide a boost when we don't make anything anymore? Although China and India and Brazil and some other emerging markets are growing quickly again, Europe and Japan, both major markets for U.S. exports, remain weak. And in any case, exports make up only about 13% of total U.S. production. Even if they were to grow quickly, the impact would be muted. I want to find about the kids. here because that's really where I want to get to. And as I communicate with other people, talking about, you know, if the economy goes ahead and recovers, the construction and finance industries bloated by a decade-long housing bubble are unlikely to regain their former share of the economy. And as a result, many out-of-work finance professionals and construction workers won't be able to simply pick up where they left off when growth returns. They'll need to retrain and find new careers. For different reasons, the same might be said of many media professionals and auto workers. And even with industries that are likely to bounce back smartly, temporary layoffs have generally given way to the permanent elimination of jobs, the result of workplace restructuring. Manufacturing jobs, of course, have been moving overseas for decades and still are. But recently, the outsourcing of much white-collar work has become possible. Companies that have cut domestic payrolls to the bone in this recession may choose to rebuild them in Shanghai, Guangzhou, or Bangalore, accelerating offshoring decision that otherwise might have occurred over many years. Ultimately, innovation is what allows an economy to grow quickly and create new jobs. And they talk about how we haven't seen anything like this before. Moving on, like I'm only getting past page one here, folks. Okay, here we go. Here's where it starts to get interesting. The recession in America's youth. I'm definitely seeing a lot of older generations saying, oh, this recession is so awful. Robert Sherman, a 2009 graduate of Syracuse University, told the New York Times in July. But my generation isn't getting as depressed and uptight, Sherman had recently turned down a $50,000 a year job at a consulting firm after careful deliberation with his parents because he hadn't connected well with his potential bosses. Instead, he was doing odd jobs and trying to get a couple of tech companies off the ground. The economy will rebound, he said. Over the past two generations, particularly among many college grads, the 20s have become sort of a netherworld between adolescence and adulthood. I have to say, I experienced some of this back in that day, I have to say. Job switching is common, continues on, and with it, periods of voluntary transitional unemployment. And as marriage and parental parenthood have receded further into the future, the first years after college have become arguably more carefree. In this recession, the term fun employment has gained some currency among single 20-somethings, prompting a small raft of youth culture stories in the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Weekly, on Gawker, and in other venues. I don't like that term, fun employment. Just wait until someone like the roach killer gets his hands on that shit. Most of the people interviewed in these stories seem merely to be trying to stay positive and make the best of a bad situation. They note that it's a good time to reevaluate career choices, that since joblessness is now so common among their peers, it has lost much of its stigma. And since they don't have mortgages or kids, they have flexibility. In this respect, they are lucky. All of this sounds sensible enough. It is intuitive to think that youth will be spared the worst of the recession's scars. But in fact, a whole generation of young adults is likely to see its life chances permanently diminished by this recession. Lisa Kahn, an economist at Yale, has studied the impact of recessions on lifetime earnings of young workers. This is where I reckon this is just, to me, earth-shattering. In one recent study, she followed the career paths of white men who graduated from colleges between 1979 and 1989. She found that all else equal, for every 1 percentage point increase in the national unemployment rate, the starting income of new graduates fell by as much as 7%. The unluckiest graduates of the decade who emerged into the teeth of the 1981-82 recession made roughly 25% less in their first year than graduates who stepped into boom times. So, during the recessions, when the corporations are starting to rehire, they reduce the pay. And everybody starts off lower. And there's no catching up further down. They talk about people who actually do get into work straight after college.
are always going to be way behind, and by the time they're 30, on average, it'll be worth $100,000 to them just in their first year alone, adjusted. That's, so, you know, when people tell me that people's unemployment and things like that, it's all choice, again, I say, fuck you. It's further on in the piece, they talk about the damage that it does to families, the damage that it does to the relationships between fathers and children. There's a really fascinating part, let me see if I can find this real quick. A study from during the Great Depression, and it's thought that this would, it's seeming that this would still hold incredibly true. Okay, here we go. Men and family in a jobless age. This I found incredibly interesting. In her classic sociology of the Depression, The Unemployed Man and His Family, Mira Komarovsky vividly describes how joblessness strained and in many cases fundamentally altered family relationships in the 1930s. During 1935 and 1936, Komarovsky and her research team interviewed the members of 59 white middle-class families in which the husband and father had been out of work for at least a year. Her research revealed deep psychological wounds. It is awful to be old and discarded at 40, said one father. A man is not a man without work. Another said plainly, during the Depression, I lost something. Maybe you call it self-respect, but in losing it, I also lost the respect of my children. And I'm afraid I am losing my wife, noted one woman of her husband. I still love him, but he doesn't seem as big a man. Taken together, the stories paint a picture of diminished men, bereft of familial authority. Household power over children, spending, and daily decisions of all types generally shifted to wives over time, and some women were happier overall as a result. Amid general anxiety, fears of pregnancy, and men's loss of self-worth and loss of respect from their wives, sex lives withered. Socializing all but caused, as well, a casualty of poverty and embarrassment. Although some men embraced family life and drew their wife and children closer, most became distant. Children described their father as mean, nasty, or bossy, and didn't want to bring friends around for fear of what he might say. There was less physical violence toward the wife than towards the children, Komarovsky wrote. In the 70 years that have passed since the publication of The Unemployed Man and His Family, American society has become vastly more wealthy, and a more comprehensive social safety net, however frayed it may seem, now stretches beneath it. Two-earner households have become the norm, cushioning the economic blow to many layoffs. And, of course, relationships between men and women have evolved. Yet, when read today, large parts of Komarovsky's book still seem disconcertingly up to date. All available evidence suggests that long bouts of unemployment, particularly male unemployment, still enfeeble the jobless and warp their families to similar degree and in many of the same ways. Now, I want to find this one guy's story. Okay, here we go. Especially in the middle-aged men, long accustomed to the routine of their office or factory, unemployment seems to produce a crippling disorientation. At a series of workshops for the unemployed that I attended around Philadelphia last fall, the participants were overwhelmingly male, and the men in particular described the erosion of their identities, the isolation of being jobless, and the indignities of downward mobility. Over lunch, I spoke with one attendee, Gus Pullis, a Vietnam-era veteran who has begun his career as a refrigeration mechanic before going to night school and becoming an accountant. He is trim and powerfully built and looks much younger than his 59 years. For 7 years, until he was laid off in December 2008, he was a senior official analyst for a local hospital. Polis said that his frustration had built and built over the past year. You apply for so many jobs, just never hearing anything, he told me. You're one of my few interviews. I'm just glad to be interviewed with anybody, even a magazine. Pullis said he was an optimist by nature, but had always believed that with preparation and hard work, he could overcome whatever life threw at him. But sometime in the past year, he'd lost that sense, and at times he felt aimless and adrift. That's never been who I am, he said, but now it's who I am. Recently, he'd gotten a part-time job as a cashier at Walmart for $8.50 an hour. They say, do you want it? And in my head, I thought, no. And I raised my hand and said, yes. Polis and his wife met when they were both working as supermarket cashiers 4 decades earlier. It had been one of his first jobs. Now here I am again. Polis' wife is still working. She's a quality control analyst at a food company, and that's been a blessing. But both are feeling the strain, financial and emotional, of the situation. She commutes about 100 miles every weekday, which makes for long days. His hours at Walmart are on weekends, so he doesn't see her much anymore and doesn't have much of a social life. And here's the bit that broke my heart. And this also points to this thing in America that I still don't understand, which is the absolute hatred and vilification of poor people and people who are struggling. I find that disgusting. It's really, really, it's so counter. You know, in America, there's nothing, there's no respect for people that put their life's work to a cause, trying to do good. And if they're poor because of it, most societies actually look at them with respect. But in America, whether it's your own doing or not, if you're poor, it's your fault and your shit. And this is where I think this is what I think speaks to this. Some neighbors were at the Walmart a couple of weeks ago, he said, and he rang up their purchase. Maybe they were used to seeing me in a different setting, he said, in a suit as he left for work in the morning or walking the dog in the neighborhood. Or maybe they were daydreaming. But they didn't greet him. They didn't say anything. And he didn't say anything. He looked down at his soup, pushing it around the bowl with a spoon for a few seconds before looking up at me. I know they knew me, he said. I've been in their home. And this is one of the things that American culture, and I know that most of the people listening to this show aren't like this. But unfortunately, you're the exception to the rule in America, I believe. Where all value is put in money and acquisition. And a guy who had been respected for all of his life now finds himself unemployed and his neighbors won't even look at him. That's just fucked up. I mean, that is just so unbelievably disgusting. And how do you change that? That's what I want to know. How the hell do you change that? And I just... This is one of those things that if David talking crap in the chat room, but I don't know. There are these really simple things that I just see being in the mindset of, and you know. Some people who might listen to this program say, shit, he's fucking America bashing. And you know, that's really not what it is. It's just out of just pure concern for the fact that the nation continues to eat itself. And this is a great example of it. Yeah, Lottie says, you know, people are teaching Greeter 101. I really hope that that's not true, but I have to believe it's true. Tim says, bash America, we need it. But, you know, I've been unemployed. I've been way underemployed. And I've been fully employed. I've also spent a lot of time working for myself. And there are very, very, very few people in this world who just want free money and do nothing. People want jobs. People want reasons for getting up in the morning. And I sometimes wonder when we talk, when you hear shit like Tom DeLay, you know, unemployment benefits just are an incentive for people to not look for work. Now, first of all, no one can live on the unemployment benefits that are given in the United States. That, first of all, is a joke. It only just kind of slows down the wolves at your door and might actually give you some gas money to get to that job interview. See, this is part of the thing of, like, if someone has zero income, how the fuck do you expect them to actually get to an interview if they can't afford a bus ticket? Okay? Let's get to the simple things. But then, I really think, this is me, there is a small percentage of people in the world that would take advantage of any system that's offered. And I think there's this very, very, very small percentage of people who are just kind of naturally lazy or feel like they're entitled. And I'm talking, we're talking just like a fucking, like, 2 people out of 10,000. But the people that constantly accuse anyone who takes an unemployment benefit of being some sort of fucking bludger would probably be the people who would be bludgers or right now in their high standings in whatever their fucking lives are bludgers right now. I look at a CEO who does nothing and makes 300 times the money that his average employee makes as a bludger, as dead weight. But it's all so ass backwards. It's all just so unbelievably ass backwards. But I'll tell you what we're going to do. We'll take a little break, a little musical break, and we're going to come back at the top of the hour, and we've got David from Maine with the mystery track of the week. And to take us out, since we've been talking about things like jobs and working people, let's do a little bit of good old Jimmy Bonds. Australian. And this song was originally written as a country tune, and well, when Jimmy gets a hold of it, it ain't gonna be a country tune for long. Working class man. You're listening to The Horn, America's liberal voice. This is Foxed Up. We'll be back after the break with David from Maine and the mystery track of the week. See you after the break.
Well, he's a steel town disciple. Well, he's a legend of his.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future. The future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95?
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95?
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
This is the Head On Radio Network. The Horn.
Hello, Cleveland! Hello, Cleveland!
It's hour two, getting all foxed up. And now, back to John on the Head On Radio Network.
Nobody knows you. Nobody even knows your name. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
All right, everybody. Welcome back to Foxed Up here on the Head On Radio Network as we start hour two of the program. I love this part of the program because, well, I get a lot less frustrated. Because we get to talk about music, and we're going to go straight to that. So on the phones is our great friend David from Maine. How you going, brother man?
Good evening, John.
How's your week been, my friend?
I had to go to the dentist, and I get the feeling that when you pay a dentist and you never say the following, be honest, how are my teeth? They're not going to be honest to you. I had two fillings and, I had the point of, I don't know what, if this is something that that I'm for or against to have a John Kerry type moment, but, I was having some, they were like, they were putting a drill on one of my fillings, and, I said, I had to signal to them that, I felt some pressure and pain, so they had to add more Novocaine. And, I don't know if it's the wisest thing to do to keep, grinding a tooth down. There has to be another way.
Yeah, you know, dentistry is one of those things that really hasn't quite advanced at the rate as other forms of medicine. It's still, you know, fairly barbaric, you know. Sometimes there's nothing worse than having to wait in a dentist's office lobby or whatever, hearing, you know, grinding noises and cracking noises and, you know, like seeing smoke from drills and things. It's still a really barbaric thing, and I don't know how you make it any better.
And then And the bad contrast about it is the they would play the AM rock, the AM rock station, so you would have the contrast of, you know, you're in the chair, you're getting Novocaine, and you're not sure what this person's doing to your teeth and how far they're going, and you're not even sure about the blood because there's no mirror or anything like that. And then you got the Bee Gees on the right in front of you, and you're like, Jesus. I mean, no, nothing against the Bee Gees, but here's my problem with mainstream radio for the most part, and this points to something, John, that I think you'll agree with me. For the most part, most of America are so attention deficit disorder. When you listen to an AM station, when they turn on these FM stations, these light rock stations, they want to hear the same 10 songs over and over and over again till you're like, enough.
It's the same thing here, man. You know, it's like the rare time that the radio ever goes on, you know, usually in a drive somewhere.
Right.
And I constantly am reminded why I don't listen to commercial radio even here, you know. Even the one rock station that has a few hosts that I actually really enjoy when they do television and whatnot, comedians and things. The playlist, it's so banal, and, you know, you'll hear the same two Foo Fighters songs. You know, I mean, we're even talking, you know, just mainstream rock stuff. And like you said, you know, these things are programmed by, you know, basically, you know, mathematical algorithms. And they want to have, you know, the songs that will guarantee that people, you know, will recognize it and not go turn. And I think that that's I think that it's false reasoning there. But, yeah, and it even freaks me out, man. The home of AC/DC. And there might be only five AC/DC different AC/DC songs that I'll ever hear on any of the stations here. You know, it'll, and you know, it's like, this is their home. This is the place where people like build monuments to Bon Scott. And you know, you'd think that in a country that launched probably, you know, the largest rock band in modern history, that, you know, radio would be pulling out, you know, obscure stuff, you know, going, hey, remember the gig in Adelaide and that kind of thing. No, it's all the same crap.
It's so lazy, John. I remember when I would take ski trips, and we would turn on the station WBLM, which is famous in Maine, and they'd play the same damn Led Zeppelin songs, the same three ones. It would be Whole Lotta Love, Stairway to Heaven. And babe, I'm gonna leave you. That's it.
Rock and roll's not in there.
Maybe rock and roll.
Because
it's kind of like
oh, we're a rock and roll station, so that fits in the keyword. We'll play rock and roll.
Oh yeah, Black Dog too. But my point is that when people hear this, see, that's the problem. When you have a dynamic artist or performer let's put this out there. You know, the big news this week is the Jimi Hendrix remaster.
Oh, man, I haven't heard him yet, but I've heard reports that it's pretty good.
Yeah, and I heard Eddie Kramer. I was sad to hear about this. Eddie Kramer was off the project, and they hired someone else. But apparently this is a configuration of an album that was supposedly to come out, and I looked at the track listing, and I like the artwork, what I see, and I hope they do well with it. And you know, I got nothing but respect and love for anyone trying to push the education of music ahead, and that you have to do these kind of things to remind people about Jimi Hendrix. So I guess you have to put out these kind of reissues to remind people. He has to be on those magazine covers, and a lot of people need to get reacquainted with him, and hopefully that'll open the door for other musicians.
The other side of it, when I was reminded, one of my neighbor's brother had, you know, basically woke up first thing in the morning and went and, you know, bought it on iTunes or whatever because, you know, he was waiting. He's a huge Hendrix nut.
Right.
But I was just really, really surprised that this actually ended up seeing the light of day, knowing some of the history of the contentious nature amongst the Hendrix family. And I haven't looked into it. Maybe you know. Did the sister actually finally get really the control of it? And is she the one that actually made this thing come to see the light of day? Because she really fought hard, if my memory serves me correct.
Well, you know, the sister is adopted. And that it causes a lot of friction in the family because Al Hendricks turned complete control over to her. Probably because some of the other relatives were unstable, whether it was drinking or drug problems, I don't know, but there is that rumor in the air. And I think part of the problem to me with the Jimi Hendrix estate, what they're doing is they continue to release things and make choices where they're selling Jimmy as a like they would sell him like a Burger King or something. They made a lot of choices in that way where they're putting out his name out and they're trying to get as much money as they can for the year. And that's the other thing, John. Let's bring it full circle. A lot of people in the music industry they just get maligned, and they get the idea of art and commerce so distorted and bound together. I think the Hendrix estate is in the same way. When they look at something like where they're making $3 million or $4 million, there's somebody on the side saying, "Oh, but you can do so much better."
Oh, yeah, there is that. And see, this is, I'm going to have to go back and, you know, because I haven't really followed it in a while because it always seemed to be a horrible distraction from just remembering Jimmy for what he was, which was just, you know, a freak of nature for his time.
Right.
But, you know, things were so screwed up that none of, you know, Jimmy and none of the family really ever saw any of the money that the Hendrix music made, if I'm not mistaken. So I know that I do think that the branding, because that's basically what I think they've done. They've gone and turned Hendrix into a bit of a brand.
Right.
And, you know, I can see what, like you said, you know, somebody, "Oh, you made this much. I can show you how to make a whole hell of a lot more." And
right.
With all the fights, do you think that could have also been a symptom of the overreaching because of how little control the family had and how it was so screwed up for so long that basically all the profits from any sales after he died were just going into the label's pocket but weren't actually going to Jimmy and the family? I mean, we're talking like, you know, straight after his death when, you know, all that rush because now he's a legend. You know, because death does that, like one of my favorite songs, Star AD from Faith No More.
Right.
You know, he suddenly became another one of the big joke. You know, you're now a legend.
I you know what? I'm going to be completely honest about the expectations of fans and listeners and audiophiles. I don't think they understand what it takes to run an estate, so I'm not going to completely criticize the whole family of that. I could probably make as many poor choices as they did if I had an estate of that size and had to just go down the list day after day, decide, well, Jimi Hendrix is going to do some radio spots on so-and-so. We need your approval for this. You know, it's going a million miles an hour, I imagine, when you have a property like that.
Absolutely. Especially one that still carries, I mean, you know, continues to carry so much value. I mean, really, you know, Hendrix is one of those things. Everyone, you know, unless you've lived under a rock or are not part of Western society at all.
Right.
You kind of, it's unavoidable. You know who Hendrix was. And if you don't, well, sorry, something's wrong with you.
You got problems.
Something's either wrong with you or your parents.
you know, John, I wanted to mention something about a great thing that I heard about music education and culture, and we should put it out there, and I think we should mention it and give kudos to, I'm sure you're familiar with Jeff Berlin. He's a virtuoso bassist.
Oh, yeah. Where should I be able to place his name?
He was big in the fusion circles. He worked with Jan Hammer.
Ah, right. Okay. Yeah, I'm with you.
But here's the impressive thing about Jeff Berlin. I like him because even though he's a virtuoso, he does things that are unorthodox, and this is what makes him controversial. And I like the fact that he pushes the boundaries like this. I don't know if you know this, but he's had a school for 10 years called Player School.
Oh, is that his? I know of it. I don't know any details, but I didn't know that that was his.
Yes. Now, it's in Florida. Now check the details on this. Anyone can sign up, and you can graduate at your own pace. And there is no audition. The only audition is, if you want to know music, you are in this school.
That's very interesting.
And it works. You know what's amazing about it? Here's the amazing thing about it. And this is why Jeff Berlin is such a genius when it comes to music education. And we could learn so much from him, because I know there's that stigma of putting people and saying, well, you're not good enough. Jeff doesn't see it that way. He's actually made people into professionals by taking this track of doing that, of people who have lesser talent, but allowing them to go at their own pace. And it doesn't, here's the other thing, John, it's awesome. You don't have a time schedule. You can go there for 20 or 30 years and get your degree. If you want to. Or you can go be out of there in 3 years or 1 year, whatever your pace is. And he allows people to do that. And I was looking at his site this week, and I was thinking, you know, these are the kind of schools that we need more of when it comes to the arts. And we need to get rid of this elitist mentality, because we're losing so many special artists out there that are just isolated in a way, and also their confidence and esteem is lowered. And what Jeff is doing, I think, is just it's immeasurable to the community in the arts.
Well,
because he's going to create so many musicians out of that who are going to be passionate about the arts and take it to another level.
You know, you kind of open up a bit of a can for me here, because, you know,
yeah.
I've been a music educator, you know, in different ways throughout my life. You know, I racks of drum students years ago, and I've got a couple of guitar students now. And you know, my mother was a music educator, and I actually take a lot of my cues on how I teach from having watched my mom. And I think what I think Berlin is capturing here is, you know, it's not how fast, it's not how quick, but whether or not you have the love for music. And one of the things that I think my mother was really, like, ahead of her time on, for someone that was teaching, say, in, you know, the 60s and 70s when she, you know, first started her career, you know, she was breaking away from, you know, the ruler across the knuckles if your hand position wasn't perfect stuff, and made put a real emphasis on making sure that once a student got to a certain level of ability, like, you know, you had to learn the basics and you had to learn proper technique and all of that, but mm-hmm. always in it was that music is something to be enjoyed. And if you're not enjoying it, you shouldn't be doing it. And if you don't put such pressure that there's a timeline about mm-hmm. every week getting, you know, like, with one of my guitar students, you know, I give her something. If she doesn't have it nailed the next week, that to me is not failure. But if she walks in and shows me that she's got a grasp of what I've shown her, and that she sees how it relates to other things, and this is the thing where some students really blow me away, that when, without you really even doing anything, that they make, like, a mental leap of faith, where suddenly they see either the way the guitar is laid out in a much more overall fashion, or see the interconnectedness of scales within chords when you're actually looking at the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
That discovery on their own is what will accelerate them more than anything you can actually teach them. when they start teaching themselves. And I bet what Jeff has created there is something that really nurtures that idea, instead of trying to go to, you know, going to achieve someone else's ideal of what being a musician's supposed to be, giving someone the time and the tools and the encouragement to find out the musician that they can be.
Well, you know, Jeff has some of the best interviews, bar none, because when they do an interview with him, it's usually a lot of people who are really cerebral and intelligent and well-read, and they understand, because in order to be into Jeff Berlin, I guess you have to have a certain you have to come from a certain type of cultural background. You have to really be into music, number one, and number two, I guess you really have to know your history when you talk to someone like Jeff Berlin. And one of the things that he said that was really interesting was he said, I noticed a lot of schools, and he was hesitant to say which schools, but he said, I don't want emulators in my school. I said, if you are going to be an emulator, how in God's green earth are you ever going to get a job? You need to find your, he goes, and it's a process, it's a painful process, I understand this, but you need to find your own personal voice. And he said, and that's what happens in a lot of colleges is they don't teach that. And they try to make people be into the new emulators, the new Jaco, the new Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Yeah.
New Wes Montgomery.
Yeah. You know,
new Stanley Clark.
Do you remember when the Musicians Institutes opened up in L.A., GIT, PIT, and all of that?
Right.
Okay, great places, and I had friends that went, you know, as technically mediocre or aspiring guitar players in a year, come back and just shred. But, when they came back, all they did was shred, and they all shredded the same way. And that's boring, you know? I mean, it's great to, you know, like, I'm a big believer in technique. You know, I studied drums properly for years. And,
right.
And technique is so much of it. But technique isn't music, though. And that's where it does get lost a bit. And like you said, you know, he doesn't want, you know, regurgitators. He wants innovators, people that find their voice to make something great that we haven't seen before.
And you see, the thing is that there's a common thing where a lot of these musicians, you'll see a lot of the people who make jumps and leaps in music. And one of the things that they did was they were basically journeymen. Mm-hmm. You had the Beatles in a place like India. Ginger Baker, when he was out of Cream, he went to Nigeria. He toured all over Africa to find out the meaning of the rhythm and feel of Afrobeat music and incorporate it into his work.
Yep.
And he said the best way of learning was to be out there in the open, just basically go without a tour guidebook and just go to see the musicians wherever you turn, wherever you turn, whatever corner you turn, whatever street you're going down, you're going to find somebody that is going to inspire and enlighten you and bring you to the place that you should be as a musician and artist.
Man, it's, I keep having, you know, because I've gotten myself back into actually, you know, a couple of organizations that are creating. And
right.
We've been having a lot of these discussions as of late, man. You know, one of the guys that I work with at the moment is, you know, one of the most technically awesome players of his instrument. However, he plays with a shitload of feel, and he can play kind of everything. And he
right.
is so sick of being a hired gun where, you know, amazing U.S. fusion or jazz or, you know, world music artist comes into Australia, can't afford to bring his band, so he hires a band here. So he goes out and plays with all these amazing people, has a great time. But again, similar, just because of the paying aspect of the job, most of the work ends up being an, you know, just repeating what someone else has done, even if you're doing it with the real dude or the real woman. But it still ends up being, here, play it this way. And I think, you know, there's so much, the live thing gets lost, and hence why, you know, after many years of being this hired gun, you know, he's got money and a studio to show for it, but after, you know, 15 years, feels a bit musically left out.
You know, the other thing that I wanted to mention to you, and you will have find this interesting, but I listen to a lot of seminars from the Red Bull Music Academy, and they try to educate a lot of DJs about upcoming artists, production techniques, mixing, arranging, DJing, all of that. But one thing I found interesting was we've talked about it before. We live in this ADD culture, and one of the musicians who was on the panel was talking, and he had just said the answer to one of the questions. He had said, and I remember when Juni Morrison was playing with Ohio Players, and I really loved what he was playing, and he just said that. And then afterwards, like exactly 1 minute, he asked the audience. Now, this is what astounded me, John. He asked the audience, he said, who played with the Ohio Players? He just told them a minute ago.
Yeah.
Guess what? Nobody in that audience knew. And that's when I realized that's another piece of the puzzle that fell in for me. I realized that mostly what's happening now is we don't put an emphasis on listening and listening skills. Because we are in this ADD culture and we don't take our time, we're not able to process information like we would like to. And here's the other thing that really, really pisses me off. Well, it doesn't piss me off. It concerns me. Is the fact that the DJs out there today, the people that are being educated in the school of DJ music, in that field, in that area, they're just teaching how to be cool and how to be hip. And how to be that brand. But they're not teaching them like they did in the 1970s and 80s, these DJs, of the records, the producers, the names, the songwriters, the arrangers. And it was like watching a blank slate. I've never seen so many DJs blank out on so many questions that they should have known right off the bat. I was like, wow. and it made me think. I was like, this is the problem, because there's so much an emphasis on, I use this metaphor a lot, there's so much emphasis on just being cool rather than educating yourself about A to Z when it comes to music.
Well, it's the idol effect. It's all about performance,
right,
and not actually music, songwriting, you know, arranging, composition. It's nothing about that. They bill it as a music show, but it's not. It's a performance quest.
Well, you know, I'll take it someplace else. One of the guys who was who did one of the seminars, he said, I am not interested in being a DJ sitting behind a laptop and just staring at my audience. I want to give you an actual show and show my actual skills rather than just playing stuff off a mouse and a laptop.
Interesting you mention that too, because when I did that Blackstreet gig a couple months ago, and I'm watching Kemet set up, and he's, you know, got those you know, virtual discs that used to control all your tracks from, you know, from your iBook, right? And I'm looking at this and I'm going, wow, I thought this guy was old school, right? But then I realized he is, right? And where he uses the technology as though it were, you know, just two turntables. You know, that's basically all he does. It just means that the library's more easily accessible. And there was no reliance on pressing play on your laptop. Once he got going, it was really obvious that he still was doing it the real way. And then the support acts shared his gear. And I watched them go at it, and it was exactly what you're saying, pressing play. And at the end of it, I said, why with half of these acts didn't you just give me the CD to have the front of house guy play track back down?
But the thing that this musician said, and this is something is so crucial and so key, people are spending their hard-earned money. They're spending hours to come see you. So when you do this, when you touch a button and you play some music off a laptop or from a mouse and everybody is doing it, and everybody is doing it from city to city, it's insulting.
It is. It absolutely is. And, you know, you mentioned about this short attention span thing. And last night, yeah, I just had another example of that kind of thrown in my face. Last week, I think I mentioned while you were on with me about having seen the most recent Green Day DVD concert that they broadcast here, and it was really
right.
And it was really great, you know. And I mentioned how, though, still even with a band like that, the edit rate was still way more. You know, clips from camera angle to camera angle were so fucking frenetic. That, you know, like, I couldn't actually, you know, being someone that's kind of curious, I couldn't actually see what anybody was playing. Now, that's just from my muso angle. But
right.
Over the weekend, I think it might have been just yesterday, that Crooks and Liars had, on the Late Night Music Club, they had a clip from the legendary Live at Budokan from Cheap Trick, right? You know,
one
of the greatest live records ever. Regardless of genre, right? And someone in the comments actually linked to where the whole concert's up on YouTube in 8 parts. So I sat there last night and watched it for the first time in a long time. And I sat there watching, and I'm like, and I counted for a while. And I actually could watch the camera stay on Robin Zander as he sang, you know, the first verse to, you know, any song. And they actually stayed on him while he sang like an entire lyric before they cut over to, you know, Bunny Carlos or anything like that, where he actually got to focus on the one guy, where, again, just this modern thing, because you can do things doesn't mean you have to all the time. And
right, right.
And I found it, and you know, here, sounding like an old guy, I don't remember when, but I find that when, you know, even with the Green Day thing, no matter how wonderfully it was mixed, beautifully shot, the stage looked incredible. I mean, you couldn't really find a flaw with the production. But still, you know, when you never stay on anybody for more than like a second and a half or 2 seconds, I think you end up being distracted from the actual music that's going on, which is supposed to be the point. And
right.
Again, watching this concert last night, and if you've never seen it, you know, anyone listening, seriously, go out and get it. Because here is a band that was kind of struggling in the United States. But they had this great, you know, they had these great tunes. But they go to Japan, and they couldn't sell tickets fast enough. And you can
right.
see, you can see in the performance, they're just running around like, can you believe how many frickin' people are here? And they're, and it obviously pumps their performance, and there's this real feeling of interaction between audience and band. And like you said, people are paying you. You know, this is your job. And you watch that, and you can actually see, because you get to watch them for a little while, that these guys are actually putting a lot of work into what they're doing. And it ends up being a really satisfying thing, you know, in the end for everybody. And I was just comparing it, you know, with all the rough camera angles and stuff that might be in there, it felt much more that I was at the show than watching an MTV video clip that was done all in post-production. And I think it's that actually has led to shortening the attention span.
You know what? I agree with you on a lot of that. I notice a lot of concert performances and shows and specials that they would do. They would do the quick hyper pan shot. Sometimes they would use like a psychedelic effect where they would change the colors and they would distract everyone. They wouldn't put the focus on any of the musicians. They would move it around so much that you would never capture. They didn't capture the of how a performance should be viewed, which it should be. You should be able to take it all in. It shouldn't be this shoddy affair where you just move it all around and then just edit, because it looks so bad. I mean, I'm reminded of like when I watched a Beyonce special. I mean, and I saw exactly what you were talking about, and I started thinking, I was like, there's a problem with this of how we're teaching people about performances and how to perform and how to shoot concerts and how to do concert specials and how to do just carry yourself on stage and all that kind of thing. A lot of that is become such a like a bad Las Vegas review almost.
And, you know, in certain situations, I can understand the quick edits. It's a way to mask, say, you know, that they're lip-syncing or they retract it after the production. You know, that kind of thing, I can see where it can be used for a reason. But, there are moments, like, just in the modern, you know, rock band, you know, soul band, whatever. There are those moments where, you know, you bring it down.
Right.
And then you have a singer that's like up there by themselves. You know, the band could be all blacked out because it's, you know, intense song for whatever reason, whether it's a ballad, you know, whatever the hell it is. But, you know, lights do something to draw the audience towards that vocalist, and everybody ends up being captivated. Everyone together is focused on this person who is focusing themselves on the performance that's going back. And I wonder if, you know, with the advent of all this short attention span kind of focused editing and things like that, have we not taught the ability to properly listen, to properly observe and take it in without looking for the next big flash? You know, I just feel like it, you know, it cheapens. And like you say about, you know, we talked about too much editing. Same idea happens in like radio when it comes to advertising and whatnot. They actually look at the waveform, and depending on how much activity looks like is in there, they kind of decide whether it's a good edit or not, and whether the message is actually being transferred. But we got a lot of stuff in there. It looks full.
Let me see if I can make a segue to my track of the day.
Yeah.
I think I told you it's 13 minutes.
Right. And you know what, man? If we got to go a little long today, I'm cool with that, because there's actually something really important. And you talked about confidence and things like that. I do want to talk about after that. But please, let's get to the track, the business at hand.
Okay, well, I want to tell people that I want to give you a disclaimer first. This track is extremely, extremely heavy, okay? And when I mean it's heavy, I wanted to do this because I remember growing up as a kid, there was always this stigma on death metal and speed metal. What they wanted to do was they wanted the same... And I got this with a lot of musicians, John. They wanted to cartoonize it the same way they cartoonized funk, so they don't take it serious as a genre. But people, I'm here to tell you that death metal, that's what we're going to play tonight, John. We're going to play death metal. Death metal is as serious as all hell. It's a cathartic expression. These musicians are extremely talented. And for anyone who is listening saying, I can't believe you're about to play a death metal track, I want you to do one thing. I want you to grab a guitar. I want you to get a set of Tama drums and lock yourself in a room for a month. And you come out with an album that you think is so easy. And I want to see what you've come up with, because I don't think you're going to come up with with what we're about to hear. And, John, let me say this. This is one of the greatest bands out right now. They've been out for 2 decades. They're from Sweden, naturally. Naturally, they're from Sweden. The band is called Opeth, and the reason why I picked this track, John, you're going to love this, is because I read a piece on the Democratic Party, the promises or the teasings and the hints that they made of what they were going to give to the people. And, John, this is about deliverance, and that's the track. It's called Deliverance. If the Democrats don't deliver anything, well, they're going to get deliverance one way or the other.
All right, with that said, let's wait no further. Here we go. Deliverance. my, David. That's outrageous.
Yeah, that band is, you'll be happy to note that they are, and you probably caught it, they are quite the listeners of Alice in Chains. They actually do an outstanding cover, I hear. I haven't heard it yet. It's on a single. It's called, they do a cover of Wood.
Oh, but I'm just, see, you're bouncing me off to this thing that I had for you, but... You know, you made that challenge of, like, you go lock yourself in a month for a month with a guitar or a Tama drum kit, and you tell me you can walk out and do anything like that, whether you like the style of music or not, the musicianship and the prowess in a track like that, that drummer, absolutely unbelievable, man. I mean, I'm not the biggest death metal fan because the vocal thing can get a bit old to me after a while.
Yeah, I understand.
But in this, it was this beautiful contrast between the guy's different vocal sounds and using that big old thing for effect as opposed to being a crutch. But man, the syncopation stuff in there just absolutely fried my head.
The thing about I think the thing about the death metal culture, a lot of people don't they don't realize is a lot of people, they're really big fans of a lot of different forms of music, and it's what you said about how it becomes tiresome and mundane to just do one thing over and over again vocally, so that's why there are those contrasts, and when you start out, of course. What happens in a lot of these progressive death metal circles, these progressive death metal circles with these bands, they start out doing that guttural moan and cathartic type of way of screaming, and then if there's a voice there, they chisel that away, and you form those melodies and harmonies. And I think the problem with a lot of people, they don't realize, and I'll even say it was kind of a conspiracy, was the fact I think they cartoonized this form of music and they basically turned it into a joke or a gimmick for the most part, anyone outside of this circle, because I hate to tell you this, but most people weren't even on their level musically. They could do so many different things when you're coming from this place. I mean, you obviously, I mean, if you listen closely, you could hear influences of King Crimson, Iron Maiden, obviously. Like I said, Alice in Chains, they're coming from a lot of different areas. Maybe Tool, you know, probably Tool because of the producer, Steven Wilson, who produces the band. He co-produces the band. He's been co-producing the band's efforts since 2001. He's a big Tool fan, too, so you'll hear a little bit of that in there as well.
Yeah, you could hear a bit on the cleaner vocals with the vocal production of, you know, making it smaller and setting it back. That's a very Maynard kind of print. But, you know, I was hearing just amazing bits of arrangement. You know, if I was able to sit there and put little time stamps on the track as it was playing, you know, there was one particular bit where it was just these really, really kind of heavily, quickly strummed little dyads and things, and it was reminiscent of the voicings of someone we were just talking about a little while ago, Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
You know, you and see, this is the thing that I sometimes think a lot of people don't realize when it comes to a genre like any kind of hard rock or heavy metal. It's about being into guitarists, and guitar players usually, once they, you know, are playing for a year or two, will start hunting out the people that influence the people they like. And if they're curious at all, they'll work their way back through time and finally end up back at Robert Johnson and Blind Blake, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, the musical history, you know, that some people actually care about and maintain, people don't really get that, you know, it's these guys that are thrashing it out that sometimes are the biggest encyclopedias of music that there are. And if you if you'll allow me to pull where I was going to go before. Now, I talked to you about this once before, and it came back up because of a study that was released here in Australia today, which I'll get to in a minute. But do you remember about a year ago, even longer ago, this came out in 2008,
right.
where they did a personality survey of different music fans?
Right.
And the whole thing where the two most similar to one another were classical musicians and metalheads.
I seem to remember this, yes.
Okay, I sent you the link there in the Skype thing.
Yeah, but, I was glancing at it.
Yeah. So, like, you know, the opening of the article is great. Put a heavy metal fan together with a classical music buff, and you might expect the results to be far from harmonious. But while the appearance could be vastly different, lovers of the two musical genres actually have much in common. Psychologists have found that classical aficionados share virtually identical personality traits with metalheads, fans of bands such as Slipknot, Megadeth, and Bullet for My Valentine. Both types tend to be creative, at ease with themselves, and introverted. Now, this I find really interesting because the thing that reminded me of this was talking about how violent music spurns violence, which I don't believe at all. And
yeah.
So automatically I came back to this and I went looking for it. And the biggest difference that they found between the two is that the classical musicians had a bit better level of self-confidence. And that can be easily attributed to the level of respect that people get on the surface when people find out what type of music that they're into. And, you know, and I've always felt this way about hard rock, is that it held a lot with classical music. I mean, in the 80s and 90s, there were all the signs of it, all the neoclassical, you know, guitar shredders and stuff, doing Bach and all that kind of thing, you know, Yin Yang Malmsteen and all that stuff. But they taught, what I do find really interesting, though, in the breakdown, you know, they say they believe fans of jazz and soul music have the best type of personality, showing positive traits such as good self-esteem, creativity, and having an outgoing nature. Okay? Now, that's the only one that's different there with the classicals and the metalheads is the self-esteem issue. But they talk about, where's the thing on chart pop? They talk about, like, in the short version, it says high self-regard. The listeners think of this of themselves, and they think of themselves as highly, that they're hardworking, friendly, gentle, but they're not creative. And I think that says that is an interesting statement to the people that fall for what is spoon-fed to them. They're not creative, and forms of music that take creativity need creative listeners. And so I think that's why classical music has its devout following that will always make sure that it stays, you know, prominent. Jazz, no matter how white Americans try to make it, will continue to stay prominent. Hard rock will continue to stay prominent because it is, every time things like hard rock or jazz and classical, I mean, classicals, you know, goes back, you know, a lot longer than it, you know, longer than anything else virtually. When it starts to get stale and it starts to repeat itself, it ends up rebelling against itself and reinventing itself. Like you saw from the glam metal 80s to alternative rock, you know, so when we went from Van Halen and all of the copycats to Metallica, Alice in Chains, REM, you know, the alternative bands, and that I still consider, you know, because I consider heavy metal just another guitar, you know, genre. It's just another rock genre. But, you know, you always see pop always does the same thing. They go with the formula, whatever the formula is, and that's it. But these other areas, the listeners have a higher expectation than, you know, and the the creators themselves have a higher expectation of themselves. So I expect that you're going to get a higher quality product in the end, even though I hate using product to describe music.
Yeah, I see where you're coming from there. I think part of the problem is I just noticed, and this is another gripe that I have with when you represent metal and when you represent good forms of metal. Now, I'm not being a music snob or anything like that, but I think the fact that they use Slipknot says a lot.
Yeah. You know, I mean, if Bullet for My Valentine, who? I would have much more gone, you know, if it had been me doing it. But yeah. Obviously the people doing the research weren't, you know, big on particular bands, obviously don't have a particular opinion, which is probably good for the study because they were going into it a bit. You know, probably a bit less biased, and probably just took off of, because these bands are kind of big, some of these bands were kind of big at the time that this was done, probably in the survey they got, you know, high hit rates on these bands. But, yeah, I would have gone back to, you know, Tool. I would have gone back to Black Sabbath, you know.
Right.
Again, like you, Iron Maiden, Judas Priest, you know, all these things. And, you know, I don't necessarily see the amount of even sharing of knowledge. You know, you go to guitar magazines and things.
Right.
And most of the guys that are out there, yeah, there's promotion involved. But these guys know that they learn from others. And most of them go out and teach because it's how you keep it going. You
right.
know, you have to invest in the next generation, and sharing knowledge is great fun. I love it. I'm hopefully very soon gonna start teaching at one of the schools in Sydney, one of the big schools in Sydney. I'm hoping this works out.
Right.
But I couldn't think of a cooler gig, really, than to be able to go and share what I have learned over 20 plus years in an industry to prepare the young ones who are going to go out there and try and make them better. And, you know, I think this whole personality thing really says a lot, you know, about who people are. And it proves that we do put a lot of our identity in the music we listen to.
I think when it all comes down to it is the fact that we obviously need to be a bit more open-minded and realize that there are a lot more creative artists out there that can come from all backgrounds, and they can inspire and make the world. That they can improve the world in ways that we can't imagine if we just give them the key or we show them the door. It's the ripples of consciousness. It's that kind of energy that needs to come forth, and bringing it back to what we were talking about. I think that's the reason why someone like Jeff Berlin sets up his school like that. Is he doesn't want to put any restrictions on who wants to study music. And if you have the passion and you're willing to put in the time and you're willing to sit in the seat, and you want to be able to find your own at your own time in your own space, the creative artist in you. I think we need to take from all of these lessons and apply them a little bit better of what people are trying to tell us in all backgrounds of music.
Yeah, and you know, I worry, you know, again talking about like the Idol thing where it's not actually a music show, it's a performance competition, right? And where I think a lot of these a lot of these music education schools go wrong is it's the same thing, that they're teaching them how to perform, which is totally important. I mean, that, you know, if you're going to go and, you know, educate yourself to, you know, business administration, you know, I mean, you really got to do this if you're going to be a musician in the modern age. You know, business administration, so you don't end up selling off your publishing rights. You know, all that kind of thing. And then there's this focus on the performance itself. And I think that that's important, but I think where some of these places, and I think Jeff Berlin's probably really worked hard to not have this happen, is mm-hmm. that it doesn't end up just being a manufacturing plant for performers. That,
right.
That, you know, it's like, okay, here's the script, here's the track, do it. And, you know, making sure that you're spurning their creativity and their curiosity, because, you know, you really need to also be able to screw up, make mistakes, and make some awful things so that you can find your way to making something truly unique. Because the real things that have changed music usually happen by accident.
Right. I think what it goes to also is the fact that if, we live in like a, I guess we could call it an E chord, D chord, A chord society. And, if you listen to the radio and you listen in particular how people respond to similar chord progressions, we alienate a lot of the, we look at them with a different lens when someone has a different chord progression. There's only a few people who can get away with it. You know, one in the mainstream. One of them was obviously Prince. Another one was Stevie Wonder.
Oh yeah.
Another person who was obviously great at the different chord structures was Jimi Hendrix. And I think part of the problem is that music needs to become. We need to realize that the music that's out there, and the outlets that are out there need to realize that just because it's different and just because it has a weird pattern to it doesn't mean that it it doesn't have any value.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, Spoon. There's so much, you know, in this, and like, you talk about like the three chord mentality. Now, that can be overemphasized because, like, you know, you mentioned Stevie Wonder. Yeah, he did some really cool things, progressions, but there's a guy that made great use of the so-called 1-4-5.
Right.
You know, and a lot of his material can come straight down to that, but it was his musicianship and making it that it didn't sound like it was that makes the difference. And you know, but there is this thing where trying to market to an expectation instead of promoting something new and different is like a defining line that has become so horrible. You know, we don't have, like, you talk about DJs as in, you know, the mixing DJs. When I think about like disc jockeys, radio guys, when they used to have control over even just half of the playlist, they could throw things in and people loved that. And it wasn't until Clear Channel, I mean, we really got to get to the heart of the matter here, where it became just filler time between advertising and stripping out all the local personality that has helped to drive this in a big way. You know, program a computer, only the top three hits can ever come up from a particular band, and, you know, all that kind of stuff, like we've talked about in the past hour, that all feeds, again, to short attention span. It feeds to, you know, if it sounds different than what you're used to, you're going to turn away from it, as opposed to having your intellectual curiosity turn and go, wow, you know, that's different. Where's this going to go? As opposed to always knowing where the ride's going to go. And to me, that's really, really boring. And Tim in the chat room asked a couple of questions here. He said, when I think of musicians teaching the younger, is music theory also a vital part of musicianship? Circle of fifths, escape tones, four-part harmony, or is it by ear? Even something as loud and grinding as metal is, they implement these theories. And he's absolutely right. You know, especially in metal, you can find, you know, like textbook examples of the modes and things, you know, that are virtually textbook, could be used as a teaching exercise. You know, and he follows up, of course, Tim, you know, has to bring Rush into it. And he says, honestly, Rush are a bunch of high school dropouts, and according to a music theory major, said that they implement the theories. So are the theories learned, or is it just played? And if played, wouldn't music sound the same without the theory? And this poses an interesting question, because there are musicians that are never taught theory, but create amazing stuff because they have a feel. But there are other people that expand their repertoire as they learn more of the theory. And I think that it's both equally, honestly. And you don't have to have a structured music theory education to create good music. But if one educates themselves to the theory, they'll better understand the things that they are creating on their own and find new ways to expand on them. So I think it's got to be a combination of all of it. And like you said, learning it when you are comfortable with, at the rate you're comfortable with, so it fits in with your development, I would think.
I did just want to mention one last thing that would interest you, because I know we've ran over time a bit.
It's all right.
There's a new documentary that's by this woman named Diana Dilworth, and it's called Melodrama, and it's about the history of the Mellotron in Chamberlain.
Ooh!
And a lot of people are talking about it, and supposedly there's obviously a lot of different musical guests in it from the past and present. There's the guitarist from Opeth in it, and there's Brian Wilson in it. There's John Bryan from Fiona Apple in the soundtrack world. And one of the things that he said that was interesting, that he said, and I found this very important that musicians and producers do this with all people of all background. When he was working on Kanye West's album, Late Registration, he wanted Kanye to know the history of sampling. So he brought him in the studio and he showed him the Chamberlain and he said, this is where this all began. And Kanye was blown away, even though he didn't come from a musician background. And that shows you an example of of how you can educate and how you can bridge to different cultures. And all it takes is that that one person in that one space and time to make that impact on a person's psyche, or to have that fact stay with them. Because in the documentary, I love the name, by the way, it's like some marketer's dream came up with it, Melodrama. One of the things they say was that the Chamberlain was pretty much a failed instrument, but it was a failed instrument again from the economic side, from making it a successful product. It never right. caught on. But what it did was, it was the archetype of sampling and the prototype of other sampling keyboards that came along. It gave that necessary spark in that space and time. So, in closing, I don't think you can, where someone comes from a conservative mindset, or someone comes from a business bean counter mindset, they look at that as a failure. But they don't understand, they don't see the bigger picture, how this failure probably created some of the best successes that were part of all of our lives.
Right, and for those that don't know what a Mellotron is a keyboard, and it's actually loaded with a whole bunch of audio tape. And when the tape ran out, you had to rewind it. So you only had so much time of the sound that you could play. And before you actually had, you know, the original machines, you actually had to back the tape up. And because you've mentioned this, I've queued up as when we end things here. I've queued up the Baget from the Tea Party, which is one of my favorite pieces of Jeff's playing. And in the track, it opens up with this beautiful mellotron, and it actually runs out before the track's over. And that was the machine. That was the limitation. But it did create a sound, and like you said, it was the first concept of a sampler. And it really did kick open that door where, you know, people are like going, yeah, the concept's really cool. And like you said, because of its limitations, it wasn't a financial success. But it spurned creativity. People had a new voice in which to use. Even with its limitations, people still fought with it. And, you know, would sometimes, even in the day, have like six of them on the road just to have enough parts to keep two of them running. And so, yeah, and it's an amazing sound. Like I said, I've got one here. I want to see that documentary because, like many things, like, say, the Flying Burrito Brothers, that album may have only ever sold 500,000 copies, but it's guesstimated that over half of those were bought by musicians who ended up creating bands.
Oh, I would like to say something about the Flying Burrito Brothers that I think is necessary for people to understand the context of why a band like that was important. Where you have a particular inspired artist or an energy, which was Gram Parsons at the time. Gram Parsons, see, this is how it all connects people. Gram Parsons led the Flying Burrito Brothers. He also inspired the Byrds to go in a more country direction. But the really important thing is, I believe Bob was talking about this a week ago or so, is that the connection to country and Rolling Stones came directly from Gram Parsons' love and passion because Keith Richards was the Flying Burrito Brothers fan.
Oh, yeah. And
Keith shows, and then that's what led Gram Parsons and Keith Richards to hang out. And that's where probably Keith Richards and Mick Jagger got the inspiration to do stuff like Honky Tonk Women,
Wild Horses,
Wild Horses, and so forth.
Yeah, yeah, and in fact, Richards and the young Parsons were so tight that he was hanging out with the Stones when he was actually supposed to be performing and recording with the Byrds, and it was that relationship that got him fired from the Byrds. I just saw the Germans, great documentary I saw, my sister-in-law has it on DVD on Graham, and it was excellent. You know, it had all the usual suspects, Emmy Lou and everybody else. But you know, they really talked about all of this stuff where, you know, and one thing I didn't realize is that actually Gram Parsons, one of the reasons that he was a little bit out of control is he actually was living off of a stipend from his very rich parents. So while everyone in his band were kind of struggling to get by, he, you know, was able to, you know, go and buy cars and fly places and, you know, do all this stuff because he actually never had to worry about any of the music making money. Because I never knew that he was actually from an affluent family and basically had a monthly allowance that more than paid for his lifestyle.
You know, it brings an interesting parallel to Miles Davis and the fact that he came from an affluent background. His dad was a dentist, and the reason why he could follow and practice and study all these jazz legends and hang around Charlie Parker and John Coltrane because he was spending his tuition just going from music club to music club. And his dad was totally against it, but he understood that his son was really talented, but he let him stay in New York. I see what you're saying. But anyways, I don't want to take any more of your time. I do want to mention that the documentary is called Melodrama. You guys can probably pick it up any place in the rentals, Netflix, Blockbuster. I'm sure it's there. The other thing is, for those people who want to know the name of the band that we played for the track of the day, it's called Opeth. OPETH. If you go to OPETH.com, you can find out all the stuff that you need to know. The great thing about this band, and this is how you know you have a work, you have a special thing on your hands, is that when the fans have trouble arguing what they find is the best work and the reasons for it, when you have that kind of synergy going and that kind of rapport with an audience that just, and where people obviously are passionate about what their favorites are, that's the kind of caliber of musicians we're talking about. And that is what people find with Opeth. And like I said, they've been around for 20-plus years, and they've had a lot of different formation changes, but somehow they've been able to continue to change in mind-bending directions.
Yep. Well, mate, you blew me away with the track today. I mean, that was... And I haven't heard that kind of syncopation work in a while, and I have to say I was a bit ignorant about that band, and I imagine Gene will be all over getting the links up on the website today so people can check it out. But man, thanks again. We went over, but it was great because I did want to talk to you about this again about this personality thing because it ended up fitting in beautifully. So next week, man, I look forward
next
to
week.
It.
Next week, I look forward to it as well.
All right, man, you take care. Thanks so much, buddy.
All right, later.
All right. And that was David from Maine. Yeah, we went a little long. And those of you that are like, get back to politics! Hey, this is a green and a music show. Don't like it? Listen to something else. But that's me. And here we go. Great example of a Mellotron at work. And if you listen closely, the very end of the song, you'll hear the kind of choir voice sound just shut off. And that's when the internal tape loops ran out. Off of Edges of Twilight, 1995. The Tea Party. The Baget. You're listening to The Horn, America's Liberal Voice. We'll be back after this.
We'll go for a Tea Party 2 for him. We'll come back and play the track that must be played. This is Silence off Edges of Twilight.
And alcohol. Everybody loves it, and so do I. And President George W. Bush will party tonight. Damn the consequences. Another shot. The sky's the limit. We resolve to party all the way to God.
Everybody, welcome back. We're coming up to the tail end of things here. And, you know, sometimes I wonder. Some comment. I thought this was supposed to be a green show. Yeah. You know what? It is. But it doesn't mean I have to lock myself into something. And honestly, right now, there's no good debates going on about doing anything. I have a story up about not so green funding of green movements, which I haven't gotten to because I did feel that the jobs thing was much more important. And, you know, sorry, it's a 3-hour program. Try and, you know, make a game plan, but you got to roll with the punches a bit. But hey, you know, like I said before, if you're not getting out of it what you thought you wanted, listen to something else. I don't have you tied to your computer. But if you're willing to be open and listen to a few things, because I actually do believe all these conversations about music and culture and art are unbelievably important.
Because without music, art, and culture, we'd have no fucking relief whatsoever from the shit that's going on in this world. Unless you want to just be stuck to pharmaceuticals or a bottle. And I consider the arts as important as healthcare. That's right. I think the world would be a much better place if we actually put lots of money into people creating. So in my little way, yeah, Dave and I have our little musical snobbery moments. But, you know, we get to get in detail about why we feel the way we do about modern culture. Because it actually has to do with media, which is politics. Now, I'm sorry if a couple people think that this is directed at them, but tough. I don't feel that I have to stick to some sort of program. And yeah, okay, we haven't been doing the green stuff quite so much. But you know what? Sometimes I get really sick of getting angry over an action. I get tired of sitting there going off and screaming all the time when I'm screaming to the converted. I kind of look at this sometimes where I need to help you guys have a break. So, you know, that's where I come from. And, you know, I have such a list of stuff that I didn't get to. But you know what? That whole thing about jobs and the youth, I took an hour on that because, in fact, I could have done the whole show on that. And you want to get to a green part of it? How about the fact that in almost every one of these situations where a certain population of the young generation, regardless of the decade, gets left behind, if we actually invested in the future of things, we could be making the best of those moments, not leaving these people behind. And, you know, I've been doing this show for a while now. And I've played pretty damn serious to, like, my founding principles. But you know what? For a while, I started to have problems doing the show. You know, And the reason why I had trouble is because, you know, I like to think of myself as someone that tries to lift people up. Try and find some positive. But, you know, you hit a point where if you focus on one subject so much that it starts to actually depress you and drag you down and make it really, really hard to be passionate about the thing that actually you care the most about. And, you know, it's like I feel like I'm scolding my audience, which is just completely insane. But this goes back to some of the things that Dave and I talk about. Audiences and their expectations. And not being able to roll with the punches when they're given something that they didn't expect. Or something that was outside their field of view. You know, if I didn't think things like music and art were so important, I wouldn't have spent a whole lot of my life living poor so I could be a part of it. And I'm not complaining. I'm not asking for any sympathy. But you gotta do what satisfies you. And that means as much for me as every single person listening on their computer right now. And yeah, I have a passion for a lot of things. My partner. This planet, my friends. And, you know, I appreciate the time that everyone spends, especially with the way that y'all chase me around when I'm not even on. You know, it makes me, even when I fail to get on, it makes me feel good that people are actually care enough. But just imagine if all Bob Kincaid did was mountaintop removal. If that's all there was. I mean, it is his leading passion outside of his family, and it's connected to his family. The actual issue impacts his family directly. But we'd all get really, 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 really bored if Bob, for 15 hours a week, just went, wah, 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 MTR. So now that I've had my little bitch, let's get on to what's actually important. And any of the stories, green ones included, that I didn't get to today, which it's unfortunate. Sometimes I wish I could do this more than one day a week, but I can't. The links are there. Gene, every single week, puts so much effort into my program. And I always feel like I shortchange him every week because I never get to a fraction of what he sent me. So, with that said, there's a reason why I find art to be so important. And the song that must be played every single show, I think, speaks to it. So with that, I'm going to calm down. I'm going to stop being judgmental of others. And here is Spearhead, and reminding you all, stay human.
Starvation is a creation of the devil, the rebel. I'm bringing food to the people like a widow, bringing flowers to a grave in the middle of the city. Isolation is a riddle, to be surrounded by a million other people. But feel alone like a tree in the desert, dried up like the skin of a lizard, but full of color like the spots of a leopard. Drum and bass pull me in like a shepherd, scratch my itch like a needle on the record, full of life like a man going to Mecca. Sky high like an eagle up soaring, I speak low but I'm like a lion roaring, baritone like a Robeson recording. I'm giving thanks for being human every morning, morning, morning. Because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. Tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming. The streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. But tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming. The negativity, we keep it at a distance. Call for backup and I'll give you some assistance. Like a lifesaver deep in the ocean. Stay afloat here upon the funky motion. Rock and roll upon the waves of the season. Hold your breath and you're underwater breathing. To be rhyming without a real reason is to claim it, not to practice a religion. If television is the drug of the nation, satellite is immaculate reception. Beaming in, they can look and they can listen. So you see, don't believe in the system. To legalize you or give you your freedom. You want rights, ask them to read them. But every flower got a right to be blooming. Stay human, because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bop. Can I hear it once again? Boom bop. But tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming. The streets are alive
with the sound of boom bap. But can I hear it once again? Boom bap. But tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming. Because all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty of the world. Because all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. Aha. Well, it's all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. Stay human. You see why 2K and 2 is a moment in time we find that we can open up a heart that's locked or been broken by the pain of words not spoken, nor shot by guns are still smoking. Cartwrights out on the Ponderosa, or drive by banging Testarossa. We need to hear the words of Dalai Lama, or at least the words of your mama. Take a mental trip to the Bahamas. Steam your body in the stereo. Sana, sana, kana. Because the streets are alive with the sound of boom bap. But can I hear it once again? Boom bap. But tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming. The streets are alive with the sound of boom bap. But can I hear it once again? Boom bap. But tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming. The streets are alive with the sound of boom bap. But can I hear it once again? Boom bap. But tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming. The streets are alive with the sound of boom bap. But can I hear it once again? Boom bap. But tell your neighbor, tell a friend. Every flower got a right to be blooming. Because all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty of the world. All the freaky people make the beauty of the world. Ha 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 ha. Because all the freaky people make the beauty of the world. Stay human.
It's just such a genius tune. And I'll tell you what, whoops, let's fix that. And, you know, let's make up for this a little bit. We'll do a little bit of musical greenness before we get out of here. And, again, talking about heavy metal. We've been talking about this where, you know, I mean, sorry, just as classical music is and just as jazz is, it's an extremely creative genre. And in my mind, during the 80s and 90s, it was the metalheads that were still singing the lyrics of peace and anti-war and whatnot when the hippies fell off and became yuppies. So one of the greatest ever environmental songs ever written, off Blizzard of Oz, Ozzy Osbourne, and Revelation, Mother Earth.
Mother, please forgive.
And I had to stop that before it went into suicide solution. Because we wouldn't have been able to fit it into the rest of the show. And for those of you that know that album, you know that it kicks into just one of the most killer riffs of all time. And what a great example of how similar metal and classical are. That entire song is a perfectly classically constructed piece of music, and Randy Rhoads was a classical guitarist. So, see how we all come full circle here? See how it all works? It all comes around eventually. Ha! Anyway, folks, thanks for being here. Thanks, David, and those that hung out through, you know, a bit of musical, you know, bloody, you know, up ourselvesness. But hey, it's just as important a subject as everything else that's being destroyed by this modern, disposable fucking society of shit. And the banality of popular culture. And how it's not actually driven by creativity at all anymore. And that's how I see it. Because I've been working in this industry for a long time. And there's a lot of people that have even more experience than I. But they'll tell you a lot of the same stuff I tell you. And for those of you that sit there going, you know, it just seems like there's a lot of crap music out there. You'd be right. You would be right. So you know what? Any of you that watch Idol, shut it off. X Factor, shut it off. America's Got Talent, shut it off. Shut it all off. Go and see something live. Go and see a band at a pub. Go see an art exhibition. Go see the chamber orchestra at your local opera house. Go see an opera. Show with your feet and your wallet how what's being spoon-fed through that fucking tube is shit. No arguments about whether the runner-up, number two or number three, might have been better than the winner on Idol. They're all shit. None of them are musicians. And if they sign up for that shit, they're either young kids that don't know any better or sellouts. And it's all just another symptom of how fucked up this world is. When great artists don't even get a look in. Don't even get a look-see. And if you pump out banal shit, that's great stuff to fill in between the advertisements. And you are exactly the audience they want to have. Break free. That's what I'm asking you. Break free. Go see something. And with that, we're going to get out of here. All right, everybody. Sorry about that. Misfired right at the end. Thanks for being here, folks. Thanks to Ben Birch at the White Rose Society for the streaming and the archives. We couldn't do this without him. Thanks to Gene, my news ninja. You rock, man. Thanks to ELO and Lottie and all the mods. Thanks to Texas Betsy. I didn't get to your link today. Damn it. But we'll see you next week. Be good. Be green.
So I stuck my hair up under my hat, and I went in to ask him why. He said, "You look like a fine, upstanding young man. I think you do." So I took off my hat and said, "Imagine that, cut me working for you." Whoa. Sign, sign, everywhere a sign, blocking out the scenery, breaking my mind. Do this, don't do that, can't you read? So I jumped on the fence and yelled at the house, "Hey, what gives you the right?"